Well, good morning. Like I said earlier, we are so incredibly excited that each and every one of you guys are here with us this morning, whether it's your first time here, your 100th time here, or whether you're checking us out at Core Online. This morning, we find ourselves embarking on part two of this six-part series that we are calling Doubting God. And over the course of these next 6 weeks, we are addressing this tension that exists inside of every single one of us. And yet it's this elephant in the room that oftentimes feels as if it doesn't get addressed within the local church. And yet if this is a tension that is real and relevant to every single one of our lives and our stories, why would we not talk about it? Why would we not lean in and have the courage to begin to discuss something that has the potential to unveil something in every single one of our lives, and maybe within our faith, and maybe just maybe in the way in which we look at God? You see, this entire series revolves around the doubts and questions and insecurities that every single one of us have faced as we've explored a relationship with God or found ourselves smack dab in the middle of a relationship with God. And for every single one of us, we find ourselves time and time again, no matter who we are, what we've come from, how we've been raised, the circumstances that we've walked through, up against doubts like these. That how within my life and my belief in God do I reconcile a good God in light of all of the bad things that are happening in our world? How do I believe that there's such a thing as a good God when he allows all of this suffering to happen all around me? Or maybe for you, you don't even have to look out into your world. It's simply, how can I believe in a good God that allows me in my personal circumstances to walk through hurt and suffering? Or maybe for you, the doubts and questions and insecurities that you've been up against, or how you reconcile a belief in a God that seems to contradict everything the world wants to tell you about science. And is it possible for me to believe in both and reconcile one to the other? Or maybe for you, the struggle that's arisen lies in the fact that how could a good God have a church full of so many imperfect people that oftentimes don't act the way that they're supposed to act, and that I've been hurt by more times than I've been hurt by people who don't associate themselves with the church? Or maybe in your story, you've picked up this book before. In your exploration of God or your attempt to be in relationship with a heavenly Father, you've picked this up, and all you've found every time you've tried to engage in this is more confusion. Or the reality that it seems as if you read one part in one section of this and then you fast forward to a different section and it seems like things are in contradiction with one another. And how do I justify that contradiction? You see, in every single one of our lives, we find ourselves with problems and struggles and questions and doubts like these and many others that leave us struggling for answers on how we deal with those things. And yet the problem that arises in our lives in the midst of our doubts and questions and insecurities, in the middle of all of the uncertainties we possess as it pertains to God and what he's doing and if he's really real and really there and really still relevant, is that somewhere along the line in all lives and in all stories, we've been led that in the moments of doubt in all lives, we have but two choices. Choice number one, we stuff it down and act as if it never existed. Because we've grown up in the church, and every message we've ever been passed along is that in order for us to be good little Christian boys or good little Christian girls, you don't have doubts about God. You don't have doubts about your faith. You don't bring up those questions. And so in order for me to keep my good standing, I have to act as if those things don't exist. Or option two, we believe that there's a choice in all of this, that when we come up against doubts and questions and uncertainties, there is something bad that is happening. It's signified by the shame and embarrassment we feel in the moments of doubts. And so if it isn't me that's bad, then it must be the thing I'm doubting that's bad. And I follow my intuition as if it's 100% accurate. And there must be something wrong, or there must be a lie in that, or there must be something inaccurate in that. And we find ourselves running away at 100 miles an hour from the things that we doubt. And yet what many of us have found along the way, time and time again, is this. Is that as we have been up against doubts and questions and uncertainties, choosing from those two options, that every time we've chosen either of those options, it's never left us feeling satisfied. It's never brought about the answers that we seek. It's never led us in a healthier direction. And so throughout this series, I want to pose a question. What if there were a third option? A third option that if we would be courageous enough to choose this third option could actually begin to answer some of our questions, would address our doubts, and would actually begin to move our lives and our futures in a healthier direction. And what I believe with all of my heart is that this third option that we have at our disposal is centered on this truth that we uncovered last week. That our doubts aren't all bad. Is that the doubts and questions and uncertainties that we have in all lives and as it pertains to our faith don't disqualify our faith. That doubts and questions and uncertainty don't have to bring with it feelings of shame and guilt and embarrassment, because doubt isn't actually the enemy of faith. No. That when we process our doubt in a healthy way, that when we lean in and seek truth, that doubt can actually be a catalyst to deeper faith in our lives. That it can actually produce growth for our present and our future in this way. That when we lean in a healthy way to the doubts and questions and uncertainties that we have, it allows us to move through a process in which we recognize the filters we bring to the table. Of the ways in which we were raised and the way in which the church we grew up in taught the Bible, or the way in which the church we're presently going to, hello y'all, teaches the Bible and filters the Bible, and the way in which my parents taught it, or the way in which I filtered it through in a time in which I needed it to say this because it would be most helpful to me if it said this, that we become people who are capable of growing by going through a process of letting go of what isn't true and holding on to what is true. That in the midst of our doubts and questions and uncertainties, we sift through all of those filters in our life to allow us to just see Jesus, who he is, what he's done, and how much he loves us. And when we just see Jesus, aside from all of those filters, in the middle of our doubts and questions and uncertainties, what I believe with all of my heart, it's what keeps me up at night, it's what gets me up in the morning, is that that is what has the power to change our lives and to change our futures. In the same way we witnessed it in five people between two services this morning, experiencing transformation in their life and taking this next step because of Jesus. But as we transition from week one into week two, and over the course of the next 5 weeks, we really get into the nitty gritty. We dive deeper into answering some of our biggest questions and biggest doubts as it pertains to our faith. That in preparation for that, there was something that I recognized about myself when it comes to almost every single doubt that I've ever encountered in my life. And it was this. That most of the doubts that I've held in my life about someone or something have ultimately originated as doubts that began about me. That ultimately in my life, what I've recognized across my past is that many times the doubts that I have about someone or something in my life began as insecurities that I saw in myself when I looked in the mirror. And maybe y'all don't know this, but I was a man before I was a pastor. And what that means is that within my life, my story, my present, and my past, there are all sorts of insecurities that I deal with on a daily basis. You name a role that I possess in my life, and there are insecurities that live there. Because what I recognize is I don't always get it right, and I have shortcomings and deficiencies as it pertains to me as a husband and father and son and brother and leader and communicator. And y'all, as we speak, I am knee-deep in insecurities right now. Because here I stand wondering what y'all are thinking about a dude that they allow to walk up on stage and speak in front of the public every single week when he obviously doesn't have a great grasp on using the English language correctly. He throws out y'all almost every single week, and I'm not even sure that that's a word. And he's not that great of a communicator. And there are all of these insecurities in every single facet of my life that I deal with every single day of my life. And yet what I've recognized is this, is that every single one of those insecurities were always birthed from something that I saw in the mirror first. They began as things that I thought about myself, that I'm not good enough, that I'm not a great communicator, that I'll never be a good enough leader, that I have deficiencies as a husband, as a father, as a son, as a brother. I've made mistakes in my past. And when those insecurities are left unchecked in any one of our lives, here's what happens. Insecurities will always spread like wildfire. They will always find a way into other facets of your life and into the relationships of your life. Because here's what I recognize about myself, is that what started as I'm not good enough, if left unchecked, will always morph into he thinks I'm not good enough. She's probably telling all of her friends all of the mistakes that I'm making. And what began as self-doubt has now morphed into mistrust within my relationships. What began as self-doubt morphed into me finding ways that I can doubt your credibility, your integrity, how good you are. That I go searching for the ways in which you mess up in those roles of your life so that I can feel better about myself, so that I can feel a little bit better than you, so that I can elevate myself by pushing you down. That when left unchecked, all of those doubts that began as self-doubt always grow into doubt that I have in the relationships of somebody else in my life. And you see, what I'm willing to bet is this, is that most, if not all of us, have experienced that in our faith. Is that we've found ourselves looking back on our past, the places we've been, the things that we've done, the mistakes that we've made. And as we look at all of those things that begin as my own insecurities, what we find is that over time, they find themselves spreading like wildfire into our faith and the way we look at God or the way we think God looks at us. And we find ourselves beginning to believe, well, there's no point in engaging in church or even going to church because God can't realistically use me. There's got to be a million better options of people who are better than me or have their life more together than me. And this self-doubt manifests itself into the beliefs that we project onto God. That this must be how God is thinking. This must be how God sees me. And y'all, I have a confession to make. I get to look at my wife every single day face to face and spend countless hours with her, and I have absolutely no idea what she is thinking on most occasions. And yet somehow in my life, I've come to the conclusion that I know what God's thinking. I know what he thinks about me. I know how he looks down on me. I know how he judges me. And y'all, that is just downright crazy. Because the truth of the matter in all lives is this, is that as we allow our self-doubt to manifest itself into our doubt of God and his capabilities to use me, the God of the universe, our Heavenly Father, our Creator, is consistently trying to communicate this into our lives and over our lives.
for you are my masterpiece.
All of your self-doubt has turned into how you think I see you, but let me recommunicate how I see you. Regardless of your mess, regardless of what you've been through, regardless of your insecurities and self-doubt that you're dealing with, let me remind you again, in spite of all of those things, how I continue to see you. This is what Paul wrote in his letter to Ephesus. For we are God's masterpiece. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus so that we can do the good things he planned for us long ago. And y'all, I don't know if you recognize this, but maybe this is the truth that you need communicated into your life. You fall into the classification in this passage of we, of us. God looks at you and says, you are created as a masterpiece. And I thought it would be helpful for us to get a deeper understanding of exactly what God is saying by giving us a little bit of a language lesson. And so I want to take you back to what this passage is saying in the original language, in the Greek language. You see, the word that we see God communicating into all life, this English word masterpiece, is the Greek word poiema. You'll find it there in your notes, and it's going to come up on the screen for you. But this word, this passage, was originally in the Greek language. And so as it was originally written by Paul, this is what Paul was communicating into our lives of what God is saying about you. This word poiema is literally translated as a creation with a designated purpose. A masterpiece. A creation with a designated purpose. And maybe some of y'all are seeing it in this moment. This word poiema is the Greek word that we get the English word poetry from. And what I find so absolutely incredible about that reality is this. It's as if God is saying, I created you as my poetic statement. You were created just as you are with all the right stuff at just the right time. For just a time as this, I have created you to be able to make a difference regardless of what you see when you look in the mirror every single day and the insecurities that you possess that have now transformed themselves into the doubt you have about me and how much I love you and how much I can use you. And yet the problem that we so often run into, and for many of us, we don't even know that we're running into this problem, is that within all lives and all stories, time and time again, throughout our past, the enemy attempts to communicate into your life and your story that you are too much of a mess for God's capabilities. You are too far gone. You are too messed up, too broken for God to do anything with you or to be able to use you. All of those mistakes that you've made, all of the shortcomings and deficiencies that you have are a disqualification to you having any sort of a better future. And yet, y'all, can I say this? There ain't nowhere in God's love letter to you and I where he communicates that. There ain't nowhere where he said that about you. No matter how far gone you feel, how many mistakes you've made, God continues to say, no. Regardless of what the enemy wants you to believe and how much of a mess he wants you to think you are still my masterpiece. And sometimes in the midst of those moments where the enemy wants to shout into our lives, you are too much of a mess to be used by God. We need to look back at the enemy and to say, you're right. I am a mess. But I have a God who specializes in using the messes to reveal the masterpiece.
I have a God who somehow operates differently than the rest of the world and doesn't choose by the ranking systems of value and worth of the world as we do, but flips the script and chooses from the bottom up. Chooses us not in spite of our messes, but for some reason it seems as if he chooses us because of our mess. Our mess that strategically positions us to be able to communicate directly hope into other people's messes and brokenness that we found ourselves in as well. And this morning, if you walked into this room and your story is one of a life where everything has always gone right, you were the homecoming king or queen, a star athlete, graduated at the top of your class, presently make seven figures, you had perfect parents, and now you grow up and you're a perfect parent, and you never make mistakes. I think there's still good news. I think God can still use you. But if your story sounds nothing like that, what I believe with all of my heart is that the God of the universe strategically wants to use you. In the midst of your mess, in the midst of our brokenness, right smack dab in the middle of our insecurities and our self-doubt, it's as if the God of the universe is plucking us out of those moments, reaching in to those moments of our lives where things seem to be messiest and saying, watch how I turn this mess into a masterpiece in and through you for the sake of the world around you. You see, what I find time and time again, when I pick up this book full of real life accounts that have happened on this earth over the course of thousands of years, what I find time and time again are story after story. And this morning we're only going to catch three snapshots, but they are three snapshots that define a consistent happening that God does in the lives of real, broken, messed up human beings like you and I, and the way in which he seems to flip the script over and over and over again in the kinds of people he chooses to use in incredible ways. You see, what I find are three distinct kinds of people that God uses most. And my hope is that as we move through these, that these three kinds of people that God chooses to use most speaks hope into your story, your doubts, your questions, and your uncertainties. The first is this. I believe that we see time and time again a God who chooses to use most often the unlikely. There's this story a couple thousand years ago that we pick up right at the very beginning of sort of this new chapter in the story of the nation of Israel. And it's a new chapter because for thousands of years, the nation of Israel had been crying to God that they wanted a king. And God had been pushing back under this premise. Why would you want a king? You're not going to get a better king than me. You put a man on the throne, and it's always going to end up way worse than it would be if you just put me, the God of the universe, on the throne of your life. And yet they just kept clamoring for a king, and finally God is like, all right, this ain't going to end up well, but I'll let you have what you want. And so he gives in, and he allows them to select a king. And the first king that they select is one that checks all the boxes by human standards and human worth. Tall, dark, and handsome. He's got it all. And yet there comes a day where God comes to a man named Samuel. And he says, Samuel, there will come a day where Saul, this king, will no longer be fit to hold office. And so what I need you to do is this. I need you to go out into the kingdom, and I need you to find the next man who will become king of Israel. And Samuel, I know this seems like a daunting task, and so I'm going to narrow your focus a little bit. The next king of Israel is going to come from one household. That's all you got to go to. Just go to one house, and when you go there, you will see a selection of sons, and it is your responsibility to find among that selection of sons who will become the next king.
And so Samuel finds himself going to the house of a man named Jesse. And as he walks through the door, he says, I'm here to select the next king from your gamut of sons. Would you bring them in? And so Jesse gathers all of his sons and he lines them up, right? You can see he like marches them in like in the police station, right? They're all lined up there in front of the numbers. And as Jesse scans over them, we pick up the story as he comes to the first son. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 6, here is how the account continues. When they arrived, Samuel took one look at this son, Eliab, and thought, surely this is the Lord's anointed. But the Lord said to Samuel, don't judge by his appearance or height, for I have rejected him. Here was Eliab, right, who had all of the same characteristics as Saul, right? He was tall, dark, and handsome. He had all the standards by the world standards of what fit to be the next king. And yet God says, his height and his appearance is not what I judge by. And y'all, I don't know about you, but in the moments in scripture in which God doesn't qualify us by our good looks or our height, for me personally, I just got to stop for a second and bask in the hope that I have, right? But there's this reality in this story, right? Where God continues, man, I don't look at it as humans look at it. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. For people judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. You see, here, there were 10 sons lined up, and he went through the line one by one. Okay, if it's not Eliab, he's got just about everything, looks and height and stature that would qualify him as a king. I guess the next one in line is almost there. He'll do good. And no, 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 until he reaches the end of the line. And there is not one of Jesse's son who is found fit to be the next king of Israel. And you can imagine Samuel looking at Jesse like, is this all you got? You got anything else for me? And Jesse looks at Samuel and he's like, well, I have one more son, but that's just a waste of time. He's the youngest of my sons and he's a shepherd boy. He's literally right now out in the fields tending the sheep. He is the runt of the litter, and right now he stinks worse than the rest of them. For me to have brought him in, there is no way that my son David could possibly be fit to be the next king of Israel. But I guess I'll bring him in anyway. And as David, the small, stinky shepherd boy, enters the room, with one look, Samuel deems he is to be the next king of Israel. The unlikeliest of choices. The one who didn't fit the mold. The one who didn't have the characteristics to become king was the very one who would grow up to become a man titled a man after God's own heart, would be one of the most powerful and wealthiest kings in all time in the nation of Israel. A man who would win many battles, who was not without mistake and fault, but a man who was used for great things. He was the unlikely choice. And it's this reality that still exists right here, right now, today in your story that God loves to use those who are overlooked by others. And if you walk through life and you feel as if you're consistently overlooked because you don't measure up to all the world's standards and all the areas of value and worth that the world has set, maybe, just maybe, the hope that you have that perfectly positions you to be used by a God who specializes in using those overlooked by others. Several years ago, when I graduated college, I took my first big boy job in ministry and I moved away. Got my first house and started my first job in a place where I literally knew nobody. I had no friends. I found a young man at that time who had a lot of similar interests to me. As we struck up this relationship and really made my first friend and someone that I could spend time with hours away from home, as we sat there and watched football and ate wings and he became more comfortable with me, he began to open up about his story and his past. And what he began to share with me as we became closer friends was this reality that in his past, it had been checkered with all sorts of mental health problems and issues. Struggles that he had dealt with for a majority of his life. So much so that he had been checked in multiple times to receive professional help as he battled things like depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts consistently in his life. And as we sat and talked, what slowly became uncovered in his life and in his story, and the insecurities he saw every morning when he looked back at himself in the mirror, was this truth. That because of who I am and the brokenness I've experienced, the thoughts that I've had, the things that I've struggled with, there ain't no way that God could possibly use me. And I looked back at my friend, and I was like, I'm just the sports director. We don't even have to title it that you're being used by God. I just need somebody to help me run a volleyball league. I just need somebody to help me line judge. I just need somebody to run a computer for me during our kids' basketball program. And he began to get plugged in, and to use the little that he had to do something. And as I transitioned through the organization, what I began to see happen in my friend is his perspective and the way he looked at his shortcomings and his struggles and his life, all of the insecurities he possessed began to become morphed as he saw himself the way in which God saw him instead of the way in which he saw himself. As he began to get more involved, the next place that he said, man, I feel like I'm just being called to this and I need to dive in and I need to do something. We had a mentoring ministry. And he said, the place in which I'm feeling called is that I want to help young men and young women who are struggling with anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts in the way I have for the majority of my life. And he jumped into this mentoring program, and what I got to witness from afar were countless lives, dozens of people on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, that this young man jumped into mentoring and was able to speak hope into their lives, not because his past was perfect, but because his past was broken. And he saw and experienced and had lived out this redemptive power, this grace that God bestowed on him that he didn't feel as if he was worth, but God gave it to him anyways. And he was able to speak that into lives, and I believe with all of my heart, I will never be able to quantify the amount of lives that are changed and different and even saved on this earth because of the ways in which God used the unlikeliest of sources right in the middle of what he felt like was his biggest messes to be able to reveal the masterpiece. God uses those overlooked by others, and he loves to use the unlikely to accomplish the impossible. What if today was the day that you stop listening to the doubts inside yourself that God can't use you? What if today was the day you stop listening to the lies of the enemy that God wouldn't use you? And begin to believe that we have a God who specializes in using the unlikely, but a God who also chooses to use the insecure. A God who uses those who struggle daily with insecurities in their life. You see, if you're anything like me and all of those insecurities that I shared with you about every single role that I possess in my life, what I've also recognized about myself is this. Is that in the midst of those moments in my life in which self-doubt runs rampant, I have a tendency to allow all of my insecurities to shout louder into my life than God's affirmations. To begin to listen to my own voice that continues to tell me you're not good enough, you'll never be good enough. The other voices in my life who repeat that exact same message. And the longer I listen to all of those voices louder than the affirmations of God and the truth that he wants to communicate into my life, the more I begin to believe that those voices are actually true. And you see, we see that exact same thing taking place in the life of a man who was called to do the unbelievable. A man by the name of Gideon, who found himself stepping onto the pages of history at a time in which the nation of Israel came up against one of their greatest foes. The Midianite army possessed over 135,000 soldiers. And in the midst of this great enemy, Gideon was being called to do something incredible at one of the most inopportune times. One of the most inopportune times, because not only was the nation of Israel coming up against an enemy that possessed 135,000 soldiers, but they were doing so at a time in which the nation of Israel only had 32,000 soldiers at their disposal. There was over a 100,000 soldier difference between these two nations who were standing face to face on a battlefield preparing to go to war. And God came to Gideon. He said, Gideon, I want you to become the leader of my army and the nation of Israel. And I want you to do incredible things. And in the very moment in which God called Gideon to do something incredible, do you know what began to rise up inside of him? All of the insecurities and all of the reasons why it couldn't possibly be him that God was calling. And God couldn't possibly use him, and he wasn't good enough. We find this in Judges chapter 6, verse 15. It says this. But Lord, Gideon replied, how can I rescue Israel? For my clan is the weakest in the whole tribe of Manasseh, and I am the least in my entire family. These are all the reasons, God, why you couldn't possibly use me. These are all the self-doubts that I have that have to be the exact same things you see when you see me. And little did Gideon know that God didn't see what he saw. And little did Gideon know that God was going to lean into all of those insecurities in bigger ways to show his incredible capabilities. Because Gideon wasn't just going to go to war and win 32,000 against 135,000. God had a different plan in mind. To put to bed once and for all the way in which he moves that takes zero consideration into all of my insecurities. You see, God whittled Gideon's army from 32,000 down to just 300 men. And yet with even greater shortcomings. What probably surfaced even greater insecurity that he was in. That they went to war with such a great contrast, and Gideon was able to come out the other side victorious. Because God uses the insecure. God loves to use the least to do the most. And the truth of the matter is that the moment you are called, the enemy will immediately remind you of all the reasons you have to be insecure. You aren't good enough. You failed at this before. You aren't smart enough. You don't have enough time. There are plenty of people who are better than you. If you did this, you'd be a hypocrite. You're too old. You're too young. You've made some big mistakes that I'm pretty sure are automatic disqualifiers to God ever wanting anything to do with you. But let me ask you this. If God didn't want to use you, Why is Satan pushing so hard in the opposite direction? If God didn't want to use you, why is Satan trying so hard to convince you otherwise? You see, I believe with all of my heart that for some of us, we've allowed these insecurities in our lives to take root for far too long. And it's relegated us to the sidelines. It's relegated us to a place where we see the game taking place and it looks like a great game, but I don't know that I have the skill to jump in. We see the band playing, but the instrument that I play can't possibly bring anything good to the table. Ben, don't you realize I just play the kazoo? I just play the cowbell. Uh-oh, here we go. SNL coming in. And yet we have a God who continues to communicate. No, I need that in the band. I need a little bit more cowbell. I need what you've got. I need you to jump in. I need you to get off the sideline. Because in the midst of your mess and your deficiencies, I strategically placed you in a place where only you can make a difference because of those insecurities, because of those shortcomings, because of that mess. But this is an opportunity for you to put those aside in the way in which I've pushed those aside to become the masterpiece I created you to become. God uses the unlikely. He uses the insecure. And lastly, God uses failures. You see, time and time again, we see God in the business of using those who don't always get it right. We saw it last week in the story of Peter. Time and time again, his failures were on display. We see it in David. We see it in Solomon. Jesus literally had a disciple whose nickname was Doubting Thomas. And yet we see it in the life of a man who arguably became one of the greatest missionaries of all time, who wrote over half of this new covenant, this New Testament, and this love letter, this instruction manual that God has given to us that has literally transformed the world. In the life of a man named Paul. Well, Paul's backstory wasn't one of success. With all the characteristics of a man that was fit to change the world, Paul's backstory was vastly different. You see, this is a snapshot into what Paul's past looked like. In Acts chapter 7, we read this story of an encounter that Paul and his followers within the Jewish religious system encounter in the life of a man named Stephen. Stephen was this guy who, after Jesus had died on a cross and then risen again, and they actually saw him come back to life, began to develop this courage and this boldness to go throughout the city of Jerusalem, which was bold and courageous stuff, because the Jews were trying to stomp out this Jesus movement. They were trying to get rid of all of these people who claimed that Jesus could change the world, had changed the world, and stomp it out as quickly as they possibly could. And yet here was Stephen trying to tell as many people as he possibly could about the hope that they could find in Jesus. As the Jewish religious leaders stumbled across this guy named Stephen, there was only one outcome that seemed fit for him: to kill him, to stomp out this Jesus movement. And this is how we find it happening. Then they put their hands over their ears and began shouting. I'm sorry, these are the squirrels that run through my head, y'all. Anybody else get this picture of like how immature the Jewish religious leaders were, right? They were like, la, 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 I'm not listening to you. And they rushed at him and dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. His accusers took off their coats and laid them at the feet of a young man named Saul. Saul was one of the witnesses, and he agreed completely with the killing of Stephen. A great wave of persecution began that day, sweeping over the church in Jerusalem, and all the believers except the apostles were scattered through the regions of Judea and Samaria. that Paul's backstory was one in which the very people who were following Jesus, he had a direct hand in the execution of many people. Paul was a murderer. And we see Paul throughout his writing struggling with this reality of all of the failures of his past. He recognized this and battled insecurities because of it. But in all of those insecurities, this is what Paul came to realize. In his letter to the church in Corinth, he wrote this: "For I am the least of all apostles. In fact, I'm not even worthy to be called an apostle after the way I persecuted God's church. But whatever I am now, it's all because God poured out his special favor on me, and not without results. For I've worked harder than any of the other apostles, yet it was not I, but God who was working through me by his grace. It's nothing that I've done, nothing that I've earned, nothing that I've accomplished. But in God's abundance of grace, he wants to use me. He wants to use you. We have a God who, right in the middle of our self-doubt and insecurities that we've transferred to him about who we are and how valuable we are, says, I'm a God who uses you when you feel unlikely, who uses you when you feel insecure, and who uses you when you feel like a failure. But what you can count on is this, is that the devil will continue to tell you why you can't. But the problem with listening to him is simply this: he didn't make you. He didn't create you as a masterpiece. He didn't number the hairs on your head. He doesn't know the purpose you were created with. And you know what that means? He has absolutely zero credibility to tell you who you are and what you're worth. So today is the day to stop giving him that voice, to stop giving him that credibility in your life and in your story, to begin to believe that you have a God who is for you, loves you, is in your corner, looks at you and sees a masterpiece regardless of what you see in yourself, a God who uses you, not in spite of your brokenness, but because of your brokenness, to do incredible things. But the question that remains is this: is today the day where you finally start living as the masterpiece you were created to be? You were created with a designated purpose, and the creator and sustainer of the universe sees that and calls that out in you. And it allows us to put our self-doubt, our questions and insecurities behind us. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for what a great God you are. God, we thank you for the ways in which you love us, the ways in which you work in our lives and in our stories. And God, the way you continue to see a masterpiece when you look at me, regardless of what I see in myself. God, we thank you for using me when I feel unlikely, for using us when we feel insecure, and for using us when all we see is a failure. And yet, God, on this day, may we be courageous enough to stop allowing the voices of insecurity around us to be louder than your affirmation. Stop allowing the enemy to tell us who we are and what we're worth. He hasn't earned that right. And so today, we stop giving it to him. today. I pray for courage. That on this day, we find a way to get off the sidelines and start living out the purpose that you've created us with. It's in your name that I pray. Amen.